Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When we think about the cycle of poverty in the United States, we often consider social service agencies as part of the process involved to break that cycle. They take over when a child is neglected or abused. They take over when the elderly need help. But legal scholar Daniel Hatcher says those same programs are legally milking the system at the expense of those children and elderly, ostensibly to pay for their care, but in reality shifting those funds to the larger state and federal coffers. Hatcher, who teaches law at the University of Baltimore, has written a new book about this process. It's entitled The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Coming up, we'll hear from a veteran human services professional in Ohio. Joining us now by phone is Daniel Hatcher. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. I'm very happy to be on your show.
Why do you call it the poverty industry?
Well, I guess most of us think of...
Daniel, may I interrupt you real quickly? Could you pull the phone away from your mouth? There's a static.
Sure. Is that a little better?
Farther.
So I think most of us think of an industry as a grouping of companies that provide a similar good of services, much like the coal mining industry. The poverty industry, however, brings in our state agencies and our states into the fold, working with these private contractors, using instead the vulnerable as a way to extract funds. So much like the coal mining industry mines rock for coal ore to be converted into profit, the poverty industry is literally mining children and the poor for aid funds and resources that are then converted into private profit and government revenue. Now, once it goes into the general state coffers, some of the money could be, again, used to help vulnerable populations, but it's really up to the state how they're going to use it, or it could just be used to build roads or whatever the budget shortfall is for that year.
When we talk about it in these sorts of terms, it's kind of hard to imagine that this is happening, but you go all the way back to feudal England to explain the sense of entitlement that has existed in the past for doing this to people.
Correct. And it's interesting to think about what used to happen back in feudal England times when, you know, children were considered chattel as a property right, and bastards, when the old Bastardy Acts were enacted here in the States. Where they were often actually used as a way to bring in funds to the king, to the crown. Now, one unique difference is what would happen then in feudal England, that often they were the children of landed gentry who were used by the crown to take their land, to take other resources for the benefit of the kingdom. Here now, what you're seeing happening are poor children and other impoverished, vulnerable adults being targeted as a source of funds.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the poverty industry. My guest, Daniel Hatcher, he teaches law. He's a legal scholar. He's devoted much of his career to representing foster children and vulnerable adults as an attorney. He's written a new book. It's called The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page and post a question or comment there, or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. Aren't the states and local human services agencies just doing this, Daniel Hatcher, to pay for the care of the children that are in their, under their care and the elderly?
Well, so one of the examples that I detail in the book are how foster care agencies across the country are using abused and neglected children to maximize Social Security funds, either disability benefits or survivor benefits that belong to the children, and then diverting those children's funds to state revenue. The rationale is that the agencies need those children's funds to pay back the cost of foster care. But the children, rightfully so, have no legal obligation to pay for their own foster care. The children aren't the ones who decided to put themselves in foster care due to abuse or neglect. And the agencies that exist to serve vulnerable children simply should not be funding themselves by taking resources from vulnerable children. It's nonsensical at best.
Don't children have a guardian ad litem or someone who can protect their interests in courts when it comes to these issues?
They do. So across the country, again, each state does it a little bit differently. Sometimes it's a lawyer, sometimes it's the guardian ad litem that's appointed for the children's interest. But what's happening with this practice of how foster care agencies are taking children's Social Security benefits, they do it behind the scenes. They don't even advise the children or their advocates when they're applying for, say, survivor benefits if a parent died. They don't tell the children they're applying for the benefits. They don't tell the children they're applying to become the representative payee to take over control of the money. And then they don't tell the children or the advocates when they're taking the money. Often the kids who may have a parent who died, and that could be not just a financial connection to a deceased parent, but an emotional connection for the child, the children aren't even informed that they have that benefit.
And there's no law protecting their right to be informed?
Not yet. There have been legal challenges that have addressed this, including in Maryland, that I've worked on with some success. In Maryland, we were able to get the court to find that there was a violation of constitutional due process rights, in part due to notice. But there have been legislative efforts. In Maryland, I've worked on a bill that would fix this. And also, there is hopefully going to be new federal legislation introduced. Congressman Davis out of Illinois may be sponsoring legislation that would help address this.
Daniel Hatcher, when did you first become aware of this trend? How did it occur to you that this was a thing?
Well, my first job as a legal aid lawyer out of law school about 20 years ago was representing children in the foster care system in Baltimore. I represented, 200-300 children probably within a year. And it was overwhelming to see what was happening to these children, both in the circumstances that brought them into care, and then that was often happening to them when they were in care. And during that process, and also doing policy advocacy work for a national child advocacy organization, I started encountering this issue of how the agencies are taking Social Security benefits and more assets. They're also taking veterans assistance benefits if a child's parent died in the military. Mm-hmm. I use an example in the book that Nebraska will even take burial plots from a child. But then I encountered more and more examples, which I found not just striking but deeply concerning, where agencies that exist to serve vulnerable populations are instead using those vulnerable populations to serve the agency fiscal self-interest.
You said you've worked on this in the courts in Maryland. Are there other states where this has moved through the courts? Are there other lawyers like you out there that have been working on this?
There are a handful of lawyers who are looking at this, including out of California and a national policy group called First Star and the Child Advocacy Institute out of San Diego. There aren't as many as I would hope. I would love to see more litigation efforts in various states to challenge these practices and legislative efforts to challenge this practice. So far in Maryland, we've unfortunately not been able to get the legislation through, and the practice has continued under both governors. So it's been a bipartisan practice, both under prior Governor Martin O'Malley and now under Governor Hogan.
When did this start to become a thing? And we also want to talk about child support benefits. We want to talk about what happens with nursing home bed taxes and that kind of a thing. But tell us about when did this poverty industry emerge in the United States?
Well, it's existed in one form or another for years, decades. Some of this has come more to light as the federal funding streams have materialized, and it's become, I think, more apparent and more stark in the level in which states are doing this as states have become increasingly cash-strapped and their human service agencies are increasingly cash-strapped. So you have states that are unwilling to raise sufficient revenue through general taxation, and these are both red states and blue states, so they're turning to other sources of funds. Often starting with their agencies that serve vulnerable populations, who can then be used to target federal aid that is intended for the vulnerable populations, but then that aid is instead used to fill budget shortfalls for the state.
Tell us about the child support enforcement stream or child support stream and how that works and how that process works in the equation that you talk about in the poverty industry.
Sure. And this could actually, again, be another child in foster care.
Yeah.
So if you have a child who's in foster care, not only would the state and the AG potentially go after the Social Security benefits, their veterans assistance benefits, and more, they would even take child support to pay back the cost of care. That's the rationale. So when a child is in foster care, the state will pursue both the mother and the father to pay back the cost of foster care. And now some of us may initially have a knee-jerk reaction that that can make sense. If you have a child who has been subjected to maltreatment, that if you would pursue the absent parent to pay back the cost of care. Several difficulties with that. One is that most children come into foster care not due to abuse but to neglect, and most neglect is a result of poverty. And then once the children come into care, there are significant efforts that are supposed to be in place to help reunify the children with families. But if you have a poor, struggling mother who has all these barriers in front of her, and then you layer on an unmanageable child support debt that doesn't even go to the child. Like, so when she pays it, her child doesn't even benefit. It's a state debt. It harms the children. It harms the parents. And in my book, I outlined, and in my prior research, that the state is likely spending more money on enforcement, on the administrative cost, than in any collection. So it's very likely bad for the state, even just from a general fiscal perspective.
So how do they determine, in these cases, what the child support payment would be? What how do they determine a level? And you're saying that that doesn't even go to the kid, that just goes right into the general revenue.
Right. That's a wonderful question, because it's supposed to be when child support is created in terms of the amount that they look at the mother and the father, and it's a transfer of payment from the absent parent to the custodial parent.
Right.
Doesn't work that way when you have a child who's not in care of the parents. States will still use the guidelines, but it's really nonsensical because, again, even though it's called child support, it's really not. It's being taken to pay back a cost of care. And what happens with that cost recovery mechanism is even when the money is obtained, like the ability to enforce these payments is incredibly difficult because the moms are poor, the dads are poor, the ability to enforce child support is almost non-existent. But when payments do come in, it doesn't actually result usually in more funds to the agencies, to the human service agencies, but rather a savings to the state. So same thing with foster care taking Social Security benefits. If the agency takes survivor benefits from a foster child, it doesn't result in more money for the foster care agency, but rather a savings to the state. The state will either take that money directly, or it will reduce its budget outlay to the foster care agency based on the money that the agency is taking from the child.
You know, one more thing I want to get at before we have to take a quick break is, Daniel Hatcher, you described the poverty industry as something of an iron triangle, comparing it to the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned about in his farewell address. What are you talking about there?
Right. Well, many of the same contractors across the country that involved in the poverty industrial complex, if you will, are military contractors such as Lockheed Martin running child support offices and the like.
So, literally, they are part of the military industrial complex, too.
Literally, they are. And then the same process exists where you have government partnering with private contractors, and then the money is used in a way that's not beneficial to the public interest.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you have funds that are supposed to be used. So if it's the military industrial complex, if you have funds that are supposed to be used to provide for the defense, part of the problem with the military industrial complex where those funds were diverted for other uses, including to private profit and to other broader government needs that don't directly help the defense as it should. Same thing happens with the poverty industrial complex where you have aid funds intended to help vulnerable populations that are instead used for government fiscal self-interest and private profit. A lot of these revenue maximization consultants that I discuss in the book, they'll actually receive their payment under a contingency fee structure. So some of the companies will help states take benefits from foster children, take funds from foster children, and then the companies get a cut, a percentage fee of how much they take.
So a company, maybe they're contracted to identify all the foster kids out there who are orphans or have a deceased parent, and then they get a cut of whatever they claim.
Of the federal aid they take from the children, right. So, and the incentive that these companies build in is they're trying to create, to have as many children in foster care determined disabled as possible, not to serve the children's disabilities, because again, the children often aren't even notified of the benefit, but to bring in more money for the state, and then the companies get a cut. So I have documents from across the country that shows what the strategies are from a lot of these revenue maximization contractors to increase the percentage disabled in a given state. Like Maryland, the goal is to increase the percentage of disabled children, those children who are determined disabled in foster care, from about 6% up to 20%.
My guest is Daniel Hatcher. He's the author of a new book. It's entitled The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Daniel Hatcher teaches law in Maryland. He has written on this extensively. Coming up, we're going to have join us a longtime, a veteran of the job and family services business in Ohio, Jack Freck. He's an anti-poverty advocate and retired director of the Athens County Job and Family Services Department. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking today about how social services agencies contribute to the cycle of poverty in the U.S. by monetizing the very people they're expected to help. Still with me is legal scholar Daniel Hatcher. He's the author of a new book on the topic. It's entitled The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Joining us now is Jack Freck. He's an anti-poverty advocate and retired after 33 years as a director of the Athens County Job and Family Services Department. Welcome to the show, Jack.
I'm glad to be here, Ann. Thank you.
We've been talking about some of the tactics used by social services agencies to maximize the revenue from children by claiming disability and survivors' benefits. Were you aware of this process when you were at the helm in Athens County?
Absolutely. I mean, this was built into the system. I mean, you can go back as far as 1975 when the federal government passed the Child Support Enforcement Acts and created the 4D program to collect child support. Primarily, it was set up to collect child support from people whose children were on public assistance, who were on welfare, which was aid for dependent children at the time.
Uh-huh.
Now, over years, it expanded out to actually collect child support for lots of the rest of the population, partly because they couldn't make any money off the administrative fee off for collecting money off
from poor people.
So they expanded it out to collect from everyone else so they could kind of take a cut to do that. We administered child support enforcement as well. That
exactly.
was part of our responsibility. Early on, there was a provision set up so that people on public assistance could keep the first $50 of child support that we collected on their behalf. And by the way, they were required to cooperate with us.
In order to get benefits.
They had to cooperate in collecting child support. So they would go through that process if they would get – if we would be fortunate enough to get some payments on their behalf, they were allowed to keep the first $50. That ended with welfare reform and then was left up to the states to decide whether or not to continue that.
And in Ohio?
In Ohio, they dropped it so that the child support payments that we collect in Ohio basically go to offset the expense of – well, partly to cover the state share – of matching requirements, state funds they were supposed to put in to match the block grant and offset the cost of the federal government.
And I'll put this to you, too. You know, Daniel Hatcher has already responded to the issue, but there's going to be people out there listening who are going to say, well, shouldn't it offset what the taxpayers are paying to take care of these kids?
Since 1975, when these programs first began, the amount of public assistance benefits that people got, and I was a caseworker starting in 73, were high enough that these folks could survive on them. They were not at the poverty level, but they were close. I mean, with cash and food stamps, you were probably at about 80-85% or so of the federal poverty level, which meant you could survive on that. Well, benefits have fallen so low since then that literally in Ohio now, in order to get cash assistance benefits, you have to have an income that's below half the poverty level. and the benefits that we provide keep you at half the poverty level. So, you know, a typical mom out there now might get, you know, $300-$400 in cash and roughly the same amount in food stamps. And we're keeping these people at sub-poverty levels. And rather than taking that child support payment that we get on behalf of that child and allowing that child to have an income that's closer to the poverty level, that's closer to what they actually need, we don't. We keep the benefits low. We still keep the money to offset the cost.
And everybody else is bringing home their paycheck doing this.
Absolutely.
Whether it's the private contractors or the people that work at the Human Services Agency. Daniel Hatcher, is this something that agencies are talking about among themselves, or is this just something that lawyers are discovering by way of practicing your law?
Well, there's layers to an answer to that question. Uh-huh. I think on the front line for many social workers, the social workers want to do what's best for their clients. Often when you get to the questions about money, right, and the agency looking to fund itself over the interests of the vulnerable populations, that's coming higher up and often driven by the state rather than the social service agency, because the states are often using their agencies as a way to bring in these funds that can then help shore up the state general fisc. The issue of child support, I just want to agree with absolutely everything that Jack just described, and I thought it was a great description. With child support, in addition to the difficulty where these greatly needed funds, when the support is paid from the low-income parents to take that from struggling children, it's also pitting poor mothers against poor fathers at a time when we should be supporting them. So there's studies out that look at what are called fragile families, when a young child is born to a low-income family, and the studies show that there's potential for these parents to work together, if not end up in two-parent households, at least to co-parent well for the benefit of the child. But when you force poor mom to sue poor dad for something called child support that the child doesn't even benefit from, and mom has to haul dad into court over and over and over again, she has no choice, right? There could be reasons she doesn't want to name the father due to domestic violence or other reasons. But you force them to sue each other, take the money, is not doing much to help that fragile relationship.
Jack Freck, are they forced to do that even when there's a domestic violence issue?
There are some provisions if there is a documented domestic violence situation.
Which is a whole other process.
Yeah, which is a whole other process where, you know, the mother can be excused from participating in that.
Okay.
Not used nearly as much as it should be, quite honestly,
right,
because it's very difficult to document.
Yeah.
And I think
most parents have no idea.
Most parents have no idea that that's even something available to them. And, of course, getting someone to admit, you know, that they are being abused or have been abused
is another hurdle.
To do it in a welfare office where you're sitting there with, you know, your caseworker and, you know, you're in an office somewhere and someone's saying, here, pour out your heart and tell me whether or not your ex-boyfriend or husband was beating you. You know, I mean, that's a very difficult situation. And I know from being responsible for doing that over all these years that the vast majority of the cases, we were not able to get to get that protection for folks. But, you know, it's still kind of the principle of the fact that we are – well, to be more specific, when we took families or took absent parents to court – and to get child support from them we said it was on behalf of
the child.
We literally were representing the state. We were not representing that mother. This was not a matter. We didn't get into custody issues, visitation, any of the things that could have benefited that child. We were only involved in collecting money from the absent parent. And we literally, we were the agents of the state, not the representative of that mother. I mean, which there's nothing that could be more indicative of the fact that was our primary goal, was to get the money for the state, not to improve the life of that mother. So that was an inherent conflict in this in terms of looking out for the interests of the child and the mother. We were really only looking out for the interests of the state.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about a system in the United States. It's emerged over the last several decades in which the state, the federal government, local agencies are monetizing the value of children, elderly people. We'll get to that in a second. And using that money to feed the general revenue coffers, not to benefit the child or the elderly person. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a couple emails, one from John, who says, admittedly, looking at this through a racial lens, is there a disparate impact on African-American children? Daniel Hatcher, did you look at that aspect of it?
I do know there's a disparate impact. It's not the focus of my book, but others have certainly written about this. In the foster care system, for example, the state will only receive federal funds if children are taken from poor families. And often the largest population of foster care children come from urban centers, and there have been studies that look at definitely a disparate impact on racial minorities and the impact of poor children and those who come from minorities. So there's a great concern. And it's connected as well to how these children are doing once they age out of foster care. The stats are lined up against former foster children, unfortunately. They end up in our prisons. They end up back on welfare or worse. The numbers are just striking. Foster children are twice as likely to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder as Iraq war veterans, right?
I was thinking about when you're just talking about survivor benefits, for example, if nothing else, those benefits could be accrued. They could be saved on behalf of the child. So when they age out of the system, they have money.
Absolutely. It could be an enormous benefit for the children, both as just a money source for the children as they age out of foster care. Also as a planning tool. The money could be used as a tool to plan for their future as they're, you know, reaching 14, 15 and thinking about aging out. The social worker could help encourage financial literacy and plan for how to best conserve those funds for the child's future plans.
And then you brought up another issue, Daniel Hatcher and Jack Freck. I don't want to please chime in if you can squeeze in word edgewise with me around. But Daniel Hatcher, something you brought up, it's a little more esoteric, but the idea that the kid knows that someone left something behind for them, that they had something, you know.
Absolutely.
It's an emotional thing more than anything.
Absolutely. I had a former foster child client in Maryland where this was an issue, where his father died, and the father was potentially even going to be a placement resource and until he died. And then the child was not even informed that the parent had left a survivor benefit. The survivor benefit happens because the parent works, pays into the system, and then it's a benefit that belongs to the child. It's a property right. It's much like life insurance. And so that money could both have benefited my client in terms of just the cash, right, the money to help as he was struggling on his own after foster care, but also that connection to his former parent to know that there was these funds that were left from a parent, and that could, I think, bring tremendous benefit to a child.
I think the examples that he's giving about the foster care system, which, you know, are true here in Ohio, obviously, as well, there's actually a larger number of kids who are in the cash assistance, the welfare system, the cash, you know, and here it would be temporary assistance for needy family of Ohio Works
TANF,
First Program.
Right.
And in Ohio right now, there's been in the last 5 years a huge drop in general of people on public assistance. They've cut the rolls more than in half. In fact, they've cut the number.
They've raised the bar, in other words, to get.
Well, they've because of sanctions, work requirements, you know, technical things. It's been intentional, I mean, quite intentional. And I know because I was administering this, it was intentional to cut families off. In terms of children. The number of kids now, there's only about 100,000 kids left on cash assistance, only about 15,000 adults. There were 60 or 70,000 adults 4 or 5 years ago, 150 or 160 or 7,000, you know, children. 75% of the children left on cash assistance right now are living what they call child-only cases, meaning they're living with their grandparents or some other relative, you know, not their natural parents, which is similar to a foster care arrangement, only, you know, because they have not adjudicated these children. These parents have not charged their own children with child neglect. They end up with the kids.
Yeah.
The payment level that they get is only about $260 a month.
And compared to a foster
care? Foster care payment would be about $600 a month. Okay, and which is still miserable to try to support this kid. But, you know, this – and the number of kids who are in that circumstances is much larger of child-only cases in Ohio than there are kids in foster care. But again, we will pursue child support from both of the absent parents to try to get them. And yet we have no program whatsoever in dealing with these child-only cases to try to reunite the family, to try to do anything that would help, you know, I mean, dealing with the fact that these kids are being raised in extremely difficult circumstances. And fortunately, I mean, they more likely not, this is a relative at least.
Mm-hmm.
But the state still is supporting these kids at an income level that is, you know, less than half of what they would give them if they were in the foster care system. So, you know, the situation for these kids obviously is very dire. And yet our biggest concern is still collecting child support on their behalf. You know, if fortunately they get back with our parents, our biggest concern is putting that parent into a work program, which most likely they will not be able to function in. And, you know, it's not that we are really trying to help these kids.
Stanley in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Stanley.
Hi. I just wanted to bring the fact to foremost about, you know, why would you make a parent a felon for back child support? And what kind of jobs can you expect a parent to get when you slap a felony on them and take their driver's license?
So is that
my son was, you know, a couple years, maybe a year or so shy of his college degree, and could not even get a decent job because every time you apply for something, you had to check a felony box.
Right.
And the
failure to pay child support made him a felon?
Absolutely. It did in the state of Ohio. And I understand that they're just now changing that.
And they're changing the driver's license thing, too. I think they're
yeah.
Jack Freck's shaking his head. Okay, maybe not. All right.
How do you drive, go to work without a driver's license? Hmm. And how do you maintain and get a decent job that can support you and pay child support when they make you a felon? Hmm. When you got 5 years of college.
Right.
And then the system only works for women going downtown. And I'm a woman who did never receive a dime of my child support for my son. So I understand the plight. But I don't understand that when he goes down to try to get things and help for him, they won't even listen to him. Mm-hmm. It's only for women. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's fair.
Okay. Well, Stanley, I'm glad you called. You know, it gives life to the stories we're hearing from Jack Freck. He's an anti-poverty advocate and retired director of the Athens County Job and Family Services Department. And also Daniel Hatcher. He's a lawyer. He's a law professor. And he is the author of a new book. It's entitled The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. We'll continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about what legal scholar Daniel Hatcher has termed the poverty industry. He's written a book about how federal, state, and local human services agencies team up with private contractors to convert everything from death benefits to child support into government revenue. That process has exacerbated the cycle of poverty in the U.S., he's written. His new book is entitled The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. He joins us by phone along with veteran human services professional Jack Freck here in the studio, who retired in 2014 after 33 years at the helm of the Athens County Job and Family Services Department. Daniel Hatcher, before we get too far flung here, I want to talk about the elderly and what you wrote about them and how that system works.
Sure. Well, one of the practices that's happening across the country is where states are using nursing homes as a way to draw down more federal aid, Medicaid funds that would be intended to benefit the nursing home residents. Unfortunately, the state of our nursing homes in this country is not good. Ohio under some report cards has received a D grade, and it's been getting worse, not better, in terms of the care, the low levels of professional staffing at the nursing homes. So there's a great need for more aid to help residents of these nursing homes, say, across Ohio. But what you have, our states have engaged in several revenue strategies, illusory revenue strategies, to claim additional federal Medicaid funds. And then, unfortunately, a significant part of that federal aid is routed to general state coffers rather than used for the nursing home residents. This happens in Ohio through the use of what's called a bed tax scheme. It's called a franchise fee, I believe, in Ohio. And those numbers have been increasing in Ohio. Some of the reports that I saw show that Ohio, that the state is taking these federal Medicaid funds from a combination of hospitals and nursing homes. I saw a 2013 document that indicated it was over $700 million a year. My guess is now it's probably increased to more like $1 billion a year that is being routed to general state coffers rather than being used as intended for Medicaid services. And that's just one strategy that's used. There's other Medicaid maximization strategies that states use.
We have an email from Frank. He sent it in before we were talking about this particular issue regarding nursing homes. But he wrote, when sending aid to countries with totalitarian governments, aid organizations have to be careful that their aid makes it to the needy rather than being intercepted by corrupt governments. From what I'm hearing, this is apparently not just a third world problem. It's disgusting that the government and the U.S. would stoop to this. And once again, Daniel Hatcher, this is a culture that's emerged over many decades. It's not somebody saying, I'm going to go get the poor people.
That's right. I think this has happened over the years. You know, as Jack indicated, even the child support program, when it was initially created in 1975, had the target in mind of replenishing state and federal revenue rather than providing those services to children. But as you have these human service agencies facing increasingly difficult, shrinking budgets, they're looking for money wherever they can get it. And unfortunately, you have a stark situation where a foster care agency that exists to serve probably the most vulnerable population among us, abused and neglected children, is actually taking resources from those children to fund itself.
What about immigrants, refugees, that kind of thing? Have you found any evidence, Daniel Hatcher, on that score as far as all of the efforts that are put together to help them?
That's not something that I focus on in my book. It is certainly very state by state in terms of what types and level of benefits that are provided to individuals who are immigrants, whether they're documented or undocumented. But it definitely is an issue across the country, to be sure.
Daniel, as you put it, there is a way to reel in the poverty industry. And you said that you don't support cutting government aid programs. So how do you de-incentivize this sort of revenue enhancement? How do you reel it in?
Right. Well, so one of the things I want to make clear in the book is that if you have a state governor who's misusing federal Medicaid funds, the answer isn't to cut the Medicaid funds from the poor, vulnerable populations who need it. It's to stop the governor from misusing the funds, right, to get that money to those who it's intended to benefit. So that's really the solution. The solution in the end is pretty simple. It's use funds as they're intended to be used. A human service agency that exists to serve the vulnerable should only serve the vulnerable. And they need to not put their own fiscal self-interest ahead of those that they serve. In the book, I go into several details that could happen through both federal laws and state laws with the Medicaid program, with the foster care program, with child support and the like, and how these reforms can happen. But the ultimate goal would be simply to make these agencies more true to their purpose, right? They exist to serve the best interests of vulnerable populations.
Jack Freck, during your 33 years in Athens County Job and Family Services Department, called different things over the years, but during that time, was this a thing? I mean, when you're talking to your colleagues, your peers in other counties and other states, is this something you talked about?
I think what I saw happen over that time is back in, and again, go back to the early 70s, there was an evolution from kind of always being this bureaucratic lump out there, but with a mission initially. And the mission was to put money in the hands of poor people to help meet their needs. And there were restrictions and there were limits and all, but that was the mission. As time went on, it got to be more focused on protecting the taxpayer initially, back in the old quality control days of, you know, Nixon and some of these folks. And then eventually, after particularly after Reagan, it almost got to be a war on poor people. It's like keep money out of their pockets at any cost, reduce the size of government, reduce, you know, as you know, the famous Ronald Reagan kind of demonizing poor people, the welfare queen and all that stuff. And it's gone downhill since then. I think the imposition of the block grant back in 96, which will be the 20-year anniversary of that, essentially succeeded in saying the federal government has no responsibility for poor kids anymore to make sure their needs are met. It literally eliminated the entitlement of that, and it left it up to the states to decide with a fixed amount of money. And what happened when that was unleashed is that the folks at the state level began fighting over that money, again, because, as Daniel said, they're cutting back funding for agencies.
Right.
People in those agencies, I mean, my agency, the administrative funds that we had came out of the same pot of money that was going to provide benefits to the clients. And, you know, this was true, though, for so many other child care organizations, feeding work, all these other organizations. It was that they needed that TANF money directly, or that the decisions about where money was going to go now were almost entirely being made at the state level. And advocates for poor people did not want to anger the governor, even if they weren't getting TANF money, even if they were getting a small amount of general revenue money. It basically meant that, you know, in order to keep yourself alive, you had to look out for those interests, not the interests of poor people. And it has played out as such. Again, the majority of the money from the TANF block grant that used to go to poor people no longer goes to poor people. The agencies that used to advocate for them now basically advocate for themselves. It's the dynamics of that. And of course, I would take this all the way back to the point of the question is, what's wrong with the rest of us? I mean, when did we all decide that sharing our money with poor people was not okay, that this was something that would hurt them? And, you know, I mean, the policies that he's talking about to fix these things start with a Congress, with the General Assembly, whose goal is to put more money in the pockets of poor people so they won't be poor, so their basic needs can be met.
The stated goal is.
If that is your actual goal, then you adopt policies that do that. So, I mean, child support would be a great example. If you simply – and one of the policies I advocated for all those years is that all the child support money that we collect on behalf of a child should go to that child until his income gets above the poverty level. Something as simple as that never got adopted, even though it was proposed numerous times.
Daniel Hatcher, you wrote about the Foster Children Self-Support Act. It's twice been introduced in Congress. Is that what you were mentioning earlier that has yet to receive a hearing, and you're thinking you're saying it might get reintroduced at the federal level?
That's correct. I work with a member of Congress from California and those prior examples of the federal bill, and now there's a member of Congress from Illinois who will hopefully be introducing a similar bill that would serve to protect children, Social Security benefits, survivor benefits, and disability benefits. I also think it's striking that one of the just to follow up on the points that Jack was just making, mm-hmm. in terms of the legislation that's needed.
Yeah.
There's a law very short in Ohio that was enacted in 2013 to maximize federal Medicaid funds, and the title is Maximizing Receipt of Federal Revenue, and it says right in the bill text, which was enacted by the Ohio legislature and signed by the governor, that the Department of Medicaid may enter into contracts with private entities to maximize federal revenue without the expenditure of state money. That conflicts with the entire structure of what Medicaid is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a matching grant program where states spend a percentage of funds that are then matched by the federal government. So that totally undercuts the intended match. And then you have states like Ohio that once those federal funds are maximized, much of it is then routed to general coffers, unfortunately.
Joe in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Joe.
Yes, my concern was with the license issue. My wife is deceased, my ex-wife is deceased, and the children, at one time she had been on a public assistance, and I had accrued what they said was like $25,000 in arrearage.
Mm-hmm.
When she died, I was paying this at $400 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And since she's died, the children are 35, 34, 33 now.
Mm-hmm.
They still continue to come after me occasionally for license. They determined that I only owed half that amount. I don't know where they came up with that. I've asked for the paperwork on it. That's an issue that just continues to reoccur with me occasionally. They come after me.
Okay. They still want money for his wife from him, and she's now deceased. Jack Frack, does that sound familiar?
Absolutely. I mean, it's you don't want to owe money to the state of Ohio. I mean, it's not a debt that's easily forgiven. It's not even just child support arrearages that we would continue to go on, you know, after for that amount of time. But, you know, we get situations and people on welfare who had an overpayment where they got an extra check or something like that, that we know they are still absolutely dirt poor, and we will pursue them for years and years to get that few hundred dollars back out of them. It's just, you know, it's just ridiculous.
And when Jack Frack's talking about we will pursue him, Daniel Hatcher, it's often private contractors that are doing the job. And you're saying you're not necessarily thinking that the problem is with the private contractors, but if they're in it for a profit, where will the money come from? I mean, how else do they make the money?
Well, I write about this in the book somewhat, that where I think if there's fault regarding what's ultimately done with the funds, it lies more with the state or with the contracting state entity, because they're the ones who drive the purpose of the contract and the language of the contract. The companies are more like hired to do the job. Now, that doesn't mean I like it when a private company is helping to take survivor benefits from foster children who have dead parents, right? But it's the state who's driving that. Initially, I do think there are ways. I mean, there's immense capacity between our state governments and private industry. I mean, the capacity there is unlimited. And if the purpose was correct, right, if the purpose was to truly help the public citizens that the contract, that the aid programs, that the public service is supposed to serve, rather than for the government and for the contractors to serve themselves, right, I think then that collaboration between government and private entities could do some good work.
You mentioned earlier, Daniel, that Lockheed Martin is part of this poverty industry, this poverty industry complex. So that's very ingrained. Is it because of their experience in the military industrial complex? I mean, how did that? These are big, big companies then we're talking about.
Yeah, Northrop Grumman is involved in child support as well.
Interesting.
I
thought they made airplanes, but...
Right. So Lockheed Martin used to run the Baltimore City Child Support Enforcement Office, the whole program, right, you know, including enforcement. So why they started getting involved, I mean, you'd have to ask them.
Because there's money to be made, right?
There's money to be made, right. And you have, Accenture is involved with many of these programs. It used to be Anderson Consulting. I mean, there's a list of unending number of companies who are involved in these programs. But actually, it's striking this child support issue, and then with driver's licenses where that connects to people being unable to work. The suspensions often happen as well because of courts pursuing court fines and fees from the poor, and then they hire private collection agencies to go after that money. Ohio does this. Mm-hmm. The collection agencies tack on an additional 30% of what's owed. The person's license is suspended because they can't pay either the court fines or the child support. Then they can't work if they can't get to the job, or if they're a truck driver and they need their car as a part.
Uh-huh.
And then if they are in an emergency and they have to drive and they get pulled over and driving on a suspended license, they get stuck with another criminal charge that makes it even harder for them to work. So the cycle just keeps continuing. But I saw striking examples of the private contractors in Maryland putting their own private interest above the decisions of what was best for the individual child in child support enforcement action.
Daniel Hatcher, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Daniel Hatcher is the author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. And Jack Frack, thanks again for joining us today. Appreciate your time as well.
Thank you, Ann.
Jack Frack is an anti-poverty advocate and retired director of the Athens County Job and Family Services Department. Thanks for your emails, thanks for your calls, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.